This is Archival Moments on VOCM. For the next hour, we'll explore the great stories and traditions that can be found in the archives of Newfoundland and Labrador. Archival Moments with Larry Doey and Brian O'Connell on VOCM.
Once again, from the rooms in St. John's, our host is archivist and director here at the rooms, Larry Doey. I'm Brian O'Connell. This is Archival Moments. Welcome.
Well, Brian, welcome back to the rooms.
Always a pleasure to be here. Lots going on. I know you guys are gearing up for your summer season. We're going to talk about some of the many events that you have just around the corner. But we have a lot to talk about today. The 24th of May, Queen Victoria.
The 24th of May is the Queen's birthday, and if we don't get a holiday, we all run away.
The glorious 24th, as people in the old colony were apt to call it. We're going to talk about when the able and the young go away to work, out migration, and Edward Morris pops up again with his diaries, and he talks about that at length.
Edward has something to say on everything, and he makes observations about everything. Thank you, Edward Morris.
And we're talking about the attempts to cross the Atlantic. Now, we know Alcock and Brown were the first, but there were many that came after. Charles Lindbergh, of course, was full 9 years afterward, and he said that, in a quote, Alcock and Brown led the way. But then the U.S. Navy got involved, and they wanted to do something.
That's right, and that's May of 1919, so that's actually 100 years ago when Trepassey was making the headlines all over the world.
And there was quite a bit of excitement because people didn't know what was on the go. These large naval vessels showed up. So we'll talk about that and some sad news for the people of Trepassey.
That's true.
So we'll share that with you. But let's start with the glorious 24th. Queen Victoria, born May 24th, 1819.
And so that's actually where we get the idea of the Victoria weekend. So she was actually died on January 22nd, 1901. And when she died, there was immediately all of the empire then was trying to figure out how do we acknowledge the contributions of this woman who sat on the throne for so many years. And so it was quickly decided, and Newfoundland, as its own country, Newfoundland actually was one of the first countries to say that, well, we already acknowledge the 24th of May, the Queen's birthday, as Empire Day.
That's right, it was Empire Day.
It was already Empire Day, so why don't we start calling it Victoria Day in honor of Queen Victoria? And so Empire Day actually remained on the calendar for something like, well, it was like 50 years, and then Empire Day became the British Commonwealth Day, and then in 1966, Commonwealth Day became the present Queen's birthday. So it's
which is what, June 10th?
June 10th, yeah, okay. Queen Elizabeth II, yeah, that's right.
But we held on to May 24th.
We held on to May 24th because of all of the contributions that Queen Victoria made really to the world, because her impact, when she was on the crown, the empire was at its best. It was its tentacles were all over the world.
Let's talk about her connection to Newfoundland.
She had many connections to Newfoundland. Like, when you really think about it, there's some wonderful stories. Some of the stories now have been a bit embellished.
Yeah.
One of the great stories that I like to tell is that you have to imagine St. John's in 1838. And there's a young priest arrives from Ireland. His name is Michael Anthony Fleming. And when he arrives in St. John's, he's determined that St. John's should have a substantial cathedral. It should have a cathedral like other major cities in the world. Mm-hmm. And so he started scouting for a parcel of land. And that parcel of land where the basilica now sits in St. John's used to be known as the Barons. Like, it was a...
Really?
It was just sitting there. It wasn't serving any purpose.
Everything was sitting in the lower part of the town, Water Street, Duckworth Street.
That's
that was
right.
It. And this was the Barons up here. Where the rooms is was, I guess, the fort was here.
That's right.
But everything else was nothing.
There was nothing. So this young priest looks up towards where the basilica is located now, and he said, what a wonderful site for a new cathedral, a cathedral in St. John's. But, of course, he had to go through the British government. He had to go through Queen Victoria in order to get title to it.
Right to Her Majesty.
Right to Her Majesty. So off to London he went. And
well, he had a lot of gall, didn't he?
He was determined. And so what he did, he eventually arranged. Well, of course, Queen Victoria wasn't very accepting initially, but she saw his determination.
But how did he meet her? Because you just don't walk into Buckingham Palace and say, Good morning, Your Majesty.
The story goes that he initially tried a number of different the traditional routes, you know, through the regular ways of making these appointments. And then that wasn't working for him. But so then he realized that Queen Victoria had a special, particular route when she went about the town. You know, she, actually what she would do, she always drove to Hyde Park. And so he apparently was in his clerical regalia. And Queen Victoria thought, now, isn't that the oddest kind of a thing? You see a Roman Catholic priest walking about in Hyde Park. So she stopped, engaged him in conversation. And that's when he said, I have come to Rome, to London, specifically to see you, to see about the possibility of getting that parcel of land in St. John's, Newfoundland, for my cathedral.
Incredible story.
And the story goes on. The story says that it was wet and miserable and raining and cold, and so she said, get in the carriage and we'll go back to Buckingham Palace and we'll have a conversation about this. They had the conversation. She gave him the assurance that the land was going to be his. And as he was leaving, she realized she took one of her shawls. She gave it to this young priest. And he wrapped himself in the shawl and actually came back to Newfoundland. And really, right up until 1955, there were photographs of this particular shawl that was allegedly given to Bishop Fleming, that he eventually passed on to a woman, Mary Shaw Dempsey, down on Alexander Street here in St. John's. So that's the story. Of
any photos exist in this?
There was. There was actually.
Really?
There were photographs that was in the Centennial Book 1955 for the cathedral that showed the shawl that Queen Victoria had given to Bishop Fleming.
He was incredibly determined.
He was.
And what a charmer.
Indeed,
he must have had quite a personality to be able to. First of all, he figured out her route, and then to dress and wait and get her attention. That's incredible.
And that's the way he did business. He did things at a very big scale and at a very personal scale. He was the one that initiated most of the work.
All right, so.
And there's another story that goes with that. So Queen Victoria, because the story goes that, and everyone tells you this story about the Basilica, everyone says what the Queen did was gave him as much land as he could fence in one day.
Yeah, that's I've heard that many times.
But the reality is when, in fact, the deed was for 9 acres of land in this area around the Basilica, around the rooms, right? So it was 9 acres of land. And what the citizens of St. John's did, Catholics and Protestants all got together, and they fenced that 9 acres of land in one day. So that's why that story came out. That
and why did the other faiths get involved in this?
Oh, they were very supportive of the work that Fleming was doing. Fleming was also introducing education.
Yeah.
He was a real advocate for you know, any kind of causes that were happening in the town.
Did they have any idea of the kind of church or basilica he was going to build?
Well, a lot of his critics at the time looked at him and said, well, you know, don't you think that's a bit large? Because, you know, I think the population of, or the Catholic population who would have worshipped at the basilica at that time would have been, you know, 9,000, and that would have extended right down around know, Bay Bulls, Wickless
Bay. I guess that's where we get the saying, go big or go home.
Oh, that's right. And he was determined to go big. And he did build a beautiful cathedral.
Now, we have Victoria in Carbonear, or behind Carbonear, as people like to say.
That's right.
And named after Queen Victoria?
Named after Queen Victoria. And so that always used to be known as the village or this Salvage Hollow. And it was basically a winter house. So the fishermen in Freshwater and Carbonear would go out to what we now call Victoria, and that's where they would have their winter house or where they could work out of in the wintertime.
And she had a hand in the pitcher plant.
She definitely had a hand in the pitcher plant. So she was... most nations were looking to something that was unique about their place. And so the unique thing about Newfoundland was the pitcher plant. And that was later designated by the cabinets in 1954 as the official flower of the province of Newfoundland.
But it was Queen Victoria who picked it out.
But it was Queen Victoria who initially picked it out. So the pitcher plant actually is something that Queen Victoria recognized as something that would that is unique.
And it how did she get involved in that? What was where did it appear?
Well, Newfoundland was considering a new coin, so they were printing a new penny, and so the newly printed penny on the reverse side had the pitcher plant.
Okay then. What about Cabot Tower?
There's another connection.
Her fingerprints are all over this place.
You know this town pretty well. So what's happening in 1897, when they're looking at building what we now call the Cabot Tower, there was Queen Victoria's Jubilee. So there was her 60th anniversary of sitting on the throne. And so the government of Newfoundland, they, was also the 400th anniversary of John Cabot discovering Newfoundland.
Yes.
It had been discovered before then, but it's John Cabot arrives in Newfoundland. And so they wanted to do something to acknowledge that, and so that's how they sold the idea. They said, we need to do something to acknowledge the contributions of Queen Victoria. It's her 60th anniversary, her jubilee. Because so this is 1897, and they're thinking about building this Cabot Tower. They were going to build something that was even more substantial. And so 1890, so just 5 years before that, the city of St. John's had burned to the ground.
Yes.
You want to build something up there on the top of Signal Hill when the people in this country or this city are rebuilding their own homes. There's still people that are living down in Bannerman Park. It's like putting a silk hat on the head of a man who can't afford to buy a pair of boots. Why would you give someone a silk hat when he hasn't got a nice pair of warm boots on his feet?
So who drove this to get it done?
Oh, there was other officials in government, and they were really quite keen on it.
And finally, Victoria Park.
Now, Victoria Park is a project dear to my own heart because I'm on a committee, and it's the Victoria Park Foundation. Everyone should Google it right now.
Sure.
Anyhow, so Victoria Park has been there for a long time, you know, and it's a gem in that end of the city. And so what we're trying to do now, do much like we've done to Bannerman Park and we've done to Bowring Park, they've been rejuvenated, they've got a new life. And so Victoria Park needs that love as well. But there's a wonderful story. In Bannerman Park, there was a caretaker. So Thomas Redmond was the caretaker, and he had a son, Patrick. So what had happened was that there were some young fellas got into the park one night, and they actually assaulted Redmond.
Oh.
The caretaker of the park. So what Prowse did, Prowse then declared that Victoria Park is a sacred place, and if anyone should touch anyone, especially the son or the caretaker himself, that he'll throw the book at him, that he will severely punish them.
Well, now Victoria Day in Newfoundland and Labrador means break out the camping gear. We're all going out to sleep under canvas.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. That's our big time to break away from home. It's all over the province. Like everyone is leaving home on the May 24th weekend. And everyone you ask in Newfoundland has got a great story about the May 24th weekend.
I want to thank Buddy, what's his name, and the other fellows for that great song, too.
On the 24th of May. So that's a wonderful song, you know, and it's gravel pit camping and all that.
Any pictures of camping back in the day on the 24th?
Oh, yes, we've got. Yeah, so we've got a lot of camping photographs that come through into the archives through private collections. So just about everyone, you took your camera out on the May 24th weekend, and so it's fairly well documented.
Victoria Day, the 24th of May, and Queen Victoria born May 24th, 1819. When we come back, the able and the young go away to work. We'll talk about Edward Morris and his diaries. So when Archival Moments continues here on your VOCM.
Archival Moments. We'll be right back on VOCM. This is Archival Moments on VOCM. For the next hour, we'll explore the great stories and traditions that can be found in the archives of Newfoundland and Labrador. Archival Moments with Larry Doey and Brian O'Connell on VOCM.
We've heard about this gentleman many times during our broadcasts of Archival Moments. And his name is Edward Morris, bank manager?
He was a bank manager here in St. John's, unrelated to the Morrises, as in the Prime Minister Morris and all that family. Very well educated, very observant. I think we've said that. What he did every single day of his life for 30 years, he went home and he would write down in his diary what had transpired during the course of that day, that evening, what he would have witnessed.
Well, there was no TV, and he probably didn't want to read, so he had a penchant for writing. Oh, First of all, where did these diaries come from? How did are they in possession of the rooms or what?
Well, so Morris married into the Howley family, yeah. and the Howley, one of the Howleys became the Catholic Archbishop, mm-hmm. and so that's how those diaries found their way into the archives of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese.
All right. Okay. So, so
150 years ago, on May the 23rd, 18, so it is 120, 150 years ago, May 23rd, 1869. So he's writing into his diary, and he's talking about something that's really, really quite, at the time, people were not shocked by it. So what he was observing the fact that about 500 men were gathering down on the waterfront, and they're getting on this boat, and they're leaving Newfoundland.
So out-migration is in our DNA.
Out-migration is in our DNA.
He wrote, "Yesterday the Merlin steamer left Shays Wharf for Nova Scotia with upwards of 500 men to work on the intercolonial railway. The saddest evidence of the depressed state of this colony, Newfoundland, that has yet been presented. When the able and the young go away to work upon the roads and other provinces in preference to remaining to prosecute the fisheries, it speaks little for the inducements of the fishermen's occupation."
So that was 150 years ago, and that's a reality that Newfoundlanders and Labradorians know, it's part very much part of
our story. Not much has changed.
Nothing much has changed. You know, we still know, and I had brothers that would still, you know, got on flights from St. John's directly to Fort McMurray. Yeah. Those flights like to be about 150, 200 men, and that was happening every couple of weeks. So,
what was the Intercontinental Railway or Intercolonial Railway?
So the Intercolonial Railway was a railway that was promised to the Atlantic provinces, especially Nova Scotia, back in 1867 when they formed Canada.
Okay.
And so part of the idea was that the whole of Canada would be connected by a railway. And so back in 1869, so a couple of years after Confederation, really what they were doing was ensuring that that part of the deal was confirmed and build that railway out of Nova Scotia all the way up to British Columbia.
The old saying, "There's a Newfoundlander everywhere," relates to this, because what Morris witnessed, as we said, is a constant theme in Newfoundland's history. We've moved everywhere in the world.
We have moved everywhere in the world, and we've been doing it, you know. So in the 1800s, for instance, immigration occurred at the largest scale. The last 2 decades of the century, so that's when the cod fishery fell in severe decline in the late 1800s. And mm-hmm. so they were leaving here in droves. But there's always been something unique about Newfoundlanders. They have left, but it's like a temporary leaving. They're going off, and they'll work in their trade for months at a time, and then return home. That's always been something, and it's something that still continues. Just think of all of the young fellows, all of the men and women, they get on those planes, and they fly up to Fort McMurray, or they fly up to Muskrat Falls. They're up there for 2 or 3 weeks, and they come home. The only difference in the 1800s and the early 1900s was that they couldn't come home every 2 weeks. It was they were getting home.
You were there
every
6 or 8 months.
Yeah. You know,
I had a friend whose father was a master on a vessel that worked the Great Lakes, and she recalls that he would leave in the spring, and they wouldn't see him again till late fall, when the lakes would start to freeze over. Of course, shipping would stop then.
And we've spoken about this before, like the huge numbers, most of us now know the Boston States. The phrase the Boston States basically refers to the East Coast, Massachusetts. So, for instance, in 1917, we were doing some research, and we discovered that the census in Massachusetts in 1917 established that there were 15,000 Newfoundlanders in Massachusetts.
Incredible.
In 1917, 15,000 that self-identified as Newfoundlanders. Now there would have been more, but they would have been adopted as Americans or identified as Americans. But there was 15,000 saying, "No, I was born in Newfoundland and I'll always be a Newfoundlander, but I'm living here in the Boston States."
My mother's family have relatives in Boston, and they have a faraway connection to Newfoundland. They've come and they visited it, but that's where all of that started.
And there's some wonderful papers that have been written, academic papers and you know, just social historians talking about that migration or the interest of Newfoundlanders. Another way of looking at the incredible number of people from the Basin States that come to Newfoundland just to do their genealogy. Mm-hmm. You get on any of those websites and you throw your name out there, I can almost guarantee you that you're going to find someone in the Boston, in Massachusetts, along that coastline,
sure,
that are going to say, oh, you've got some connection to my family.
What about New York?
New York is wonderful, because I was talking to someone a few weeks ago, so 1930s and 40s, Carbonear, Conception Bay, that whole bay,
yeah,
the huge numbers of men that were leaving there to go and work in New York and on the high steel. So these big towers are being built, and it's incredible the number of Newfoundlanders that went there. In fact, the New Yorkers had a nickname for Newfoundland. In Newfoundland, the nickname, the New Yorkers referred to the Newfoundlanders as fish. They simply said fish.
Okay.
So you're a fish, which basically meant you're from Newfoundland.
Yeah.
And there's that iconic image. Do you remember the
image? Yeah,
the high steel image.
If you go into the, I'm trying to remember the tower in New York, and maybe it's the Empire State Building, but you can have your picture taken. But those men on that girder are right behind you on that. Don't tell me they're all Newfoundlanders.
Most of them are Newfoundlanders. I think five have been identified as Newfoundlanders,
okay,
like without question. And the others are a Mi'kmaq from Kenesaki. From Quebec.
And the
Newfoundlanders, they were very, very at home in high steel.
Really?
Because they were fishermen.
Oh, yes, of course.
And fishermen had great sense of balance.
Yeah, yeah,
and, you know, sometimes that when you're out on the water and it's a foggy day, you know, and you're walking around, you can barely see your,
sure,
you don't see your feet beneath you, but you have a better sense of, always had a better sense of balance.
That's incredible. I guess every time someone from occupational health and safety looks at that picture, they shudder.
Yeah, and what's incredible, that photograph, like they're there and they're very casually opening up their lunch tins.
Having lunch.
One fellow's there having a smoke and, you know, just, and there are thousands and thousands, you know, one slip and they're gone.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no harnesses, there's no...
No, nothing, that's what I say,
nothing,
yeah.
There's nothing.
Let's talk about modern history, I mean, because we're still seeing that incredible out-migration.
Well, that incredible, and we all experienced that in 1992 when they shut down, the moratorium was imposed. So in the years following that, 1996 to 2001, there was 47,000 people left Newfoundland. They pulled up stakes and left to go to other provinces.
Now, despite baby bonus incentives and other government efforts, the population is still shrinking over the next couple of decades, more than any other province in Canada.
And the Conference Board of Canada predicts by 2035 that our population will be down to about 480,000.
Mm.
You know, I'm hoping that's wrong,
yeah.
But that's just a prediction. You know, I'm certain and sure, like with, but we're pretty creative people,
yeah,
and so my hope is that, you know, that's not going to happen, that our numbers will surge again.
What about people coming to Newfoundland? Any bright spots?
Well, we actually need people to come to Newfoundland. When you think about it, like in 2018, just think about this, there were 4,921 people, 4,921 that died.
Yeah.
There was only 4,000 born in Newfoundland.
Incredible.
So that's 900 people right off the bat that you've got to find, you know, just to fill it. The signs of hope are you know, our government are actively working on international immigration.
Yeah.
So I think last year numbers, typically the numbers over the last few years have been about, you know, a little less than 400 people have been moving to Newfoundland.
Right.
But, you know, we're getting some of the brightest, the smartest, you know, who want to come here. They love this place,
yeah,
because of its, well, some love the isolation,
yeah,
some love the entrepreneurship. They certainly love the people, how,
yeah,
you know, and they're welcomed here. And not a reception that they're getting in some places in the world.
All right. When people come to the rooms and they're searching out this information, how can they find this out, people in the Boston States and that sort of thing?
Well, we've got, you know, the reference staff would be the best,
yeah,
to direct you to it, because they know the collection so,
yeah,
well. But there's, you know, all of these stories are buried in diaries and letters, and you'll find them, or we'll direct you to them. You just tell us what part of the world you're interested in. So if you're into Iowa, for instance, I was totally fascinated to find out that back in 1920s, there were about 21 young women left Newfoundland to go off to the state of Iowa in the United States of America, because all the convents here in Newfoundland, these were women who wanted to join the convents.
Yeah.
But the convents were bus net rafters. There was no more space.
Yeah.
And so the nuns here were saying, well, you know, maybe you should go off to the
I know someone to Arkansas.
And Arkansas as well.
Incredible.
And they built, and I followed the career path of some of these women, and they became, you know, they opened orphanages and hospitals and schools and retirement homes, and they were the leadership. They were some of our smartest young women that went off.
Well, there you go, out-migration and how it impacted the old colony back in the day. We're going to come back and talk about flying the Atlantic, the American attempt, when Archival Moments continues here on your VOCM.
Archival Moments. We'll be right back on VOCM.
So this time around, Newfoundland at the crossroads of the flights across the Atlantic, and there were many.
There were many, and this is a storyline that I wasn't really familiar with. I've done some reading about, you know, May 1919 and June 1919. So June 15th, 1919, that's when Alcock and Brown, they make that nonstop Atlantic flight. So that's in the history books, and that was out of St. John's.
Well, they get 10,000 pounds for that, from the Daily Mail.
10,000 pounds for that, which was huge sum of money.
Yeah, I do say.
So all the activities happening in St. John's. So you have four crews, they're all in competition, but at the end of the day, it's Alcock and Brown.
So who are the others?
The other group, there were four teams, and so there was the Hawker and Mackenzie Grieve. There was Raymond and Morgan, the British aviators, and then there was the Handley Page Company, that the British pilots, an American aircraft manufacturer, that's three, and then the Alcock and Brown ones, right? Mm-hmm. But now all of the attention's on the town, on St. John's, but meanwhile,
what's going on in Trepassey?
May the 5th, 1919, 100 years ago, what happened in Trepassey was that there were three naval vessels, huge American naval vessels, pulled into the port. And so the Evening Telegram here in St. John said, my God, we're hearing from Trepassey that there's naval vessels showing up out there.
And this is just after the First World War.
That's right after the First World War. So now they send a reporter from St. John's out to Trepassey. And his very first story back to St. John's reads something like this.
Never before in its uneventful history has the small settlement of Trepassey been filled with such excitement as today permeates that place. For from a vague idea of what the much talk of transatlantic flight is, the little village has in a flash become a very center of operations, and already the people there have become used to the sight of nearly a dozen American cruisers anchored in the harbor.
So can you imagine, you get up in the morning and you look out into the harbor and there's at least one dozen huge naval vessels. And then, but that reporter was some saucy though, didn't you think?
The uneventful history
has the small settlement of Trepassey.
So these vessels were unannounced, unexpected?
These vessels were unannounced, unexpected, and they're sitting there in the harbor, and everyone is in you know, Trepassey, St. John's, they're all sitting around the embankments there, and they're wondering what is going on.
He says the furor caused by the entirely unexpected arrival of the USN Kistu late Friday afternoon, and that caused on Saturday by the arrival of two others, the flagship Prairie and the seaplane mothership Aerostock, has best be left to the imagination.
So the writer is really saying you have to imagine 12 big warships, naval vessels, sitting in Trepassey Harbor. That's about 2.5 miles long. And so then what happens, of course, is they quickly realize, because everyone knows about the transatlantic flight.
And that's happening in St. John's.
That's happening in St. John's. And now they put the crowd in Trepassey, put it all together. Oh, this has got something to do with flight as well. And so what had happened from one of these vessels, the Aerostock, they take off a small biplane, And what they do then is that the biplane is a seaplane, and they start flying around the harbor, and they do that several times.
Well, that must have raised a few eyebrows and a lot of excitement.
Would have been the first time that people would have seen an aircraft,
yeah.
right? Unless, you know, someone had, from Trapez, sure, yeah. St. John's area, had some experience with the First World War, but for many. And so the writer then just describes, you know, this is a wonderful scene, so he just reported.
The reporter wrote, as in the case of the Martinside biplane test flight, the gulls and other seabirds that were peacefully floating on the water were startled out of their calm and flew away to safety out of reach of this new manner of bird that had invaded the quietness and placid air of the port. The gentle sheep, the more spirited goats, and the ponies that browsed along the grassy slopes of the immediately surrounding country were panic-stricken at the sight of this seaplane, and more so at the unearthly sound of the powerful motor, and for a long time after the flyer had dropped back to the harbor, they capered madly about the fields and the winding lanes that constitute the roads of the village.
And so that was the response of the animals, you know, people, you know, so these animals had never heard these sounds before of a plane flying over, so they're, you know, racing around the fields. But it wasn't just the animals, and so that newspaper reporter goes on to say,
not less than the animals, it must be admitted, the people themselves were shaken out of their customary staidness, and for hours after they met in little groups and discussed this new wonder that had come amongst them. And a most amusing feature of these conferences were the wild hazards of the natives as to what drove the plane and what kept it in the air. This problem has not been solved at Trapassi yet.
So everyone in Trapassi was there trying to figure out, oh my God, how does that thing stay up in the sky? And,
how many people said la?
La.
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 Well, I can remember. I remember when I was really young, and mother would be hanging out the clothes, and I'd be have the basket, so she'd take the pins out of the basket, and that's all my job. And one day there was a plane went over. I looked at mother, and I said, how does that stay up in the sky? And then, you know, she just looked at me, you know, like, really? Do you want me to figure that out now?
I'm too busy with the laundry.
I'm too busy.
Be quiet, Larry.
And so that was the early morning flight, and you get all of that reaction, and everyone at Trapassi. So now at 1:30 that same day, they put the plane up again, and, you know, just, and still people are in awe, in absolute awe. Right?
There was a repair ship with them.
Well, and that's what a lot of people in Trapez, they were totally fascinated that there was one ship, and that ship was called the Prairie, and it was one of the oldest ones that was in the fleet, and she was a repair ship, and she had a complete machine shop, forge. She had it all.
Wow.
Like, there was equipment that was on that ship that wasn't available in Newfoundland. That's what some of the locals were observing.
So they had a problem. They could repair it on site.
And on that particular ship, that's the Commodore, Glenshaw was his name. So he was responsible for 57 ships connected with this attempt across the Atlantic. And so his headquarters was on the Prairie. And then the Americans really, too, were looking to bring attention to the fact that they were very advanced in terms of the new technology, these new aeroplanes. And so they had four movie cameramen representing different companies in the United States, and they had two press correspondents, like from the biggest newspapers in the world, that were on this vessel as well.
Now, they weren't sending just one airplane.
No, actually, they had a number of... The ones that are flying around the harbor, the test ones, were the smaller ones. Yeah. They were just trying to get a sense of the winds and all of that. What they were really waiting for was the Navy Curtiss machines. So the NCs was the nickname that was given to these. And so the NCs were the ones that were eventually, they were going to fly into Trapassi. So what you had happening was that they were starting in Massachusetts, and then they were flying into Halifax, about an eight-hour flight. Then they were flying into Trapassi, and then they were leaving Trapassi and going to the Azores. So there wasn't a direct route. They just wanted to prove that, you know, this new...
That was a longer flight.
A longer flight. But okay. So they were not part of the direct solo flight. They just wanted to prove that... you know, this is new technology and this is workable technology. And the idea of those 57 ships that the Commodore was responsible for, they were stationed about 25 nautical miles from each other, right across that flight path that they were going to go, yeah. So that the planes always had some contact on the ocean.
So if there was an issue...
If there was an issue, yeah, then they could...
They could be rescued.
They could be rescued.
What was the final destination?
The final destination was Portugal. Lisbon, Portugal was the ultimate, well, Porto, but it was Portugal was okay. The final destination.
And the Americans were competing or weren't competing for that Daily Mail prize?
They were not. No. So that was a separate one. So that prize was very specific. It was a non-stop flight direct from Newfoundland to Europe.
So, Lieutenant Richard James.
Well, there's a Newfoundlander everywhere.
Ah.
And so the crowd in Trepassey were quite pleased to find out that there was a fellow that was on the vessel who was largely responsible for all of the coordination. And so this was a young fellow who had roots in Trepassey. So his name...
Really?
Yeah. So there was Richard James. And so Richard James's people left Trepassey in the 1890s, went to the United States, and they settled in and into the States. And so 30 years after he leaves Trepassey, he comes in, and it's his boat that guides all of the other 12 boats into Trepassey Harbor.
The newspaper wrote, his occupation before Trepassey left him with a knowledge of the harbor, and it was he who piloted in the other ships upon arrival here. There are several people who remembered the old native, and the entire village, needless to state, is proud of him. The fact that after 30 years' absence, he could successfully pilot the cruisers in the harbor is a high tribute to the knowledge and skill of Lieutenant James.
And so they were really tickled, you know, that one of their own had, you know, risen to this rank in the American Navy.
Now let's talk about the hand of hospitality.
The hand of hospitality, who can do it better than the people of Trepassey? So what, of course, what happens is that now all of a sudden you have 12 vessels that arrived on the 6th.
That's a lot of seamen.
That's a lot of seamen. And so they were trying to figure out, well, what are we going to do? We've got all of these people. Yeah. Now, of course, accommodations wouldn't have been an issue because they were on shore. They could have left and then went back to their ships. But the crowd in Trepassey were determined to have a good time. And so the newspaper reported that last evening a dance was held in one of the houses and several sailors being present, while numerous individual men were invited to the homes in the village. So what's happening, of course, you've got these hundreds of men wandering around Trepassey trying to figure out what to do with themselves. There's not a lot to do in Trepassey back in 1919. Now, my friends down in Trepassey now, of course, it's a metropolis, and, you know, you'd be very busy socially.
Yeah.
But in today, so the newspaper actually reporter, he actually said, Trepassey is not a second New York.
Oh, wow.
And so these fellows are coming in, of course, and they don't have no idea. You know, they're on these naval vessels, and they're just after leaving Cuba was their last placement.
Oh, wow, okay.
So now they come into Trepassey. And so the newspaper reporter...
The sailor boys were a little disappointed over Trepassey, for even to the most optimistically minded, Trepassey is not a very modern city. And although careful not to say this or anything else that would give offense, their long faces told their own story. To make matters worse, the weather, although delightfully clear and fine, was exhilaratingly keen. And having recently returned from Cuba, the Americans felt the cold pretty badly.
So imagine you've just left Cuba and you arrive in Trepassey Harbor in May of 1919, 100 years ago. And so, of course, now all of these young fellas, they get off. And so the big thing in the day was that, you had to find postcards. Well, there were no postcards in Trepassey.
Yeah.
Trepassey just was not ready for... Yeah. You know, this tourism crowd.
I guess if you were the shopkeeper in Trepassey, you must have done very well that
day.
That
shopkeeper. I don't know who the shopkeeper was, but the newspaper reporter reports that there was one shop that was in Trepassey, and he says that was besieged and raided, and every stick of gum and every cigarette and every drink that was in the place was absorbed. And then he goes on then to talk about the postcards and how disappointed some of these Americans were that they couldn't get a postcard.
So the airplanes finally arrived?
Yes, so the airplanes, so it was a Friday evening, May 16th, and three of these NCE boats, the flights, roared and turned down Trepassey Harbor and flew off into the gathering darkness over the Atlantic. And so, of course, then they leave here, and there's a couple of more stops after Newfoundland because it wasn't a direct flight.
Yeah.
And they end their journey. So that was the 16th of May they left Trepassey, and it was May 27th when they arrived in Tagus, Portugal.
You are.
And that's the story of Trepassey and its connections with aviation. But
the
chapter unfolds again because there's a young woman, Amelia Earhart.
Yes, of course.
In a few years' time is going to show up in Trepassey again.
Well, we've talked about that. I'm sure we'll talk about it again here in Archival Moments. I'm Brian O'Connell with Larry Doey. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the things happening here at the Rooms in St. John's when Archival Moments continues on your VOCM.
This is Archival Moments on VOCM. For the next hour, we'll explore the great stories and traditions that can be found in the archives of Newfoundland and Labrador. Archival Moments with Larry Doey and Brian O'Connell on VOCM.
And as always, we'd like to leave you with some of what's happening here at the Rooms. I know we're moving into the very busy summer season, and cruise ships will begin to arrive, and you'll have visitors from all over. What's happening?
And we're just gearing up. Something that people should put on their calendar right away. We've got an opening reception here on May 31st at 7:30 p.m., and that's the opening of the summer exhibitions at the Rooms.
Okay.
And I'm pretty excited about several of these, but in particular one. There's an exhibit called Future Possible, Art of Newfoundland and Labrador from 1949 to the present. So that's over 100 artworks and objects brought together on the 70th anniversary of Confederation to pose the question, what comes next?
Okay.
So imagine someone is given the task to pull some of our best artwork and artifacts since 1949 to represent the best of our artwork or to tell the stories about Newfoundland and Labrador. So that's that opens up on May 30th. The exhibit opens on May the 18th.
Okay.
So May the 18th is a keen day, and then May 31st is the official reception. And there's four other exhibits that are also going to be.
Now, is that reception
summer.
A ticketed event, or is it
no,
just open
reception.
To the
public? We love people to come out for the reception. It's just a great evening to come out and have some finger foods and a glass of wine and just enjoy your evening and then just go into the galleries, right? So it's a fun evening.
Tell me about the songs and ballads of County Wexford and Newfoundland.
So there's a couple of people came over from Wexford. There's a Michael Fortune and his wife, Eileen Lambert, and they're folklorists, I guess, the best way to describe it. Eileen's got a beautiful voice, and so she gave me this tape, Songs and Ballads of County Wexford and Newfoundland. And what it is, it's basically she's looking at the songs of Wexford, and then she did some research on Newfoundland, and she found out we're basically singing the same songs.
Yeah.
It's just that we've put a Newfoundland spin on a lot of the old Irish tunes. And we've either changed the tune, or we've changed the words, right, the lyrics. And so that's on May the 19th, Sunday, May the 19th, from 2 to 3 o'clock.
And her children are going to perform?
And her children, yeah. She's got three little kids, I guess, 9, 7, and 5. They've got fabulous voices. And so they're going to be singing some of the, some of the children's songs. And there's lots of animation that goes with that. You know, these kids are, they love singing. They love to share their Irish culture with us.
Well, what is Future Possible?
So Future Possible is the exhibit that's opening up on May, I think it's May the 18th, the exhibit officially opens up. And that's where we examine the cultural identity of Newfoundland and Labrador. So that's Murray Egan was tasked with looking at what's in our collection that's post-1949 that's a good representation of the history of Newfoundland and Labrador.
Oh, okay.
So that's quite an awesome task when you think about it. You get to choose 100 artifacts or paintings or archival documents that best represents what Newfoundland has been since 1949.
All right. Coffee and culture. We had Wordsworth's nephew in Labrador?
Little did people know.
Really?
Just a man. William Wordsworth, you know, the poet.
So who was the nephew?
The nephew was a minister, George Hutchinson, who came over to Labrador, over to Battle Harbour, and he was here for a number of years. And he was the favourite nephew of William Wordsworth, and there's some correspondence. So that's Marie Wadden is, after doing all that research, and so she's here on Thursday, May 23rd, and that's 2:30 to 3:30.
So is that a ticketed event? Or
That's by admission.
Okay.
Included with admission is the face.
All included in the price of the ticket.
That's right.
Right. What about the 50s night?
50s night, I'm already now. I'm doing a lot of research on what did people wear in the 1950s because I wasn't even born.
Okay.
We've been.
He looks at me with disdain.
I might raid your closet.
Yeah. And I don't think I have much left there.
In the 50s? Well, so what it is it's 50s night, through the decades is the theme we're going with. It's rock and roll music, and it's so the early days of rock and roll music, so we're talking Chuck Berry,
there'll be a
Elvis.
Few people there who can dance.
That's right. My old dance instructor, Judy Nee, will be there.
Oh, okay.
So you'll see us fly across the floor, I'm sure.
All right. Look, is that a ticket event as well, though?
That's a ticket event, yes. So best thing to do with the 50s night is to go online. And those tickets, they're going to sell pretty fast, because people are really quite interested. There's lots of people, like if you're vintage, that would be interested in.
Do you stop that?
Okay, sorry. You're pretty sensitive.
All right. And finally, the Harp Petting Zoo. Not moving us along quickly or anything.
No, not trying to change the subject. No. Moving on to harps away from rock and roll. Uh-huh. Now, that's some slip. So what's happening on Sunday, May the 26th, we have the Harp Petting Zoo. So really, there's three wonderful harpists bringing their harps here to the rooms. Vicky Greenslade, Jacqueline Cook, and Alexa Laurie. They're bringing their harps, and they're going to play their harps, but if you want to come over and get a demonstration or a conversation about a harp, the history of the harp, whatever you might want to indulge yourself in, that's going to be your opportunity.
Well, that's great. All right. Look, this is just the tip of the iceberg.
That's right. I keep saying to people, go online, check it out online, and you'll find out what's happening. And for people who are not online, we publish a monthly calendar of what's happening. So, just drop in or ask someone to drop in and pick it up for you. But there's lots of stuff that's
happening. And, of course, become a member.
Become a member.
Because then you'll get email blasts that will keep you in touch with everything that's happening here.
That's
rooms.
Right.
All right. Larry Doey is director and archivist here at The Rooms. My name is Brian O'Connell. Thank you for listening. Thank you for hosting again this week. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Archival Moments from The Rooms in St. John's on your VOCM.
Join us next week as we celebrate the colorful history of Newfoundland and Labrador with Archival Moments on VOCM.